Hi, everyone, and welcome to Education for Sustainable Democracy. I'm Brett Levy. This episode is part one of my conversation with John Silva and Miriam Romais of the News Literacy Project. The News Literacy Project is a nonprofit organization that provides programs and resources for educators and the public to teach and learn about how to be smart, engaged consumers of news and information. In this segment of our discussion, John and Miriam tell me about the organization, their free online curricula, how news literacy can be taught across the curriculum, and much more. Part two of this interview will be released in a few weeks. And thanks to all of you for listening. If you're just joining us, welcome. And if you've been listening for months, welcome back. I really appreciate your support and hope you learn some useful things from this podcast. If you like the show, please tell a friend or two or three about it. And you can learn more about the show at www.esdpodcast.org. Thank you all. Now here's part one of my interview with John Silva and Miriam Romais. John and Miriam, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's great to have you here.
Thanks.
Well, thanks very much for having us.
Just to get us started, could you say a bit about the importance of news literacy and what inspires your work overall?
Yeah, that's sort of the big question of the work that we do. The best way to approach it is to just look at the things that are going on in the news today. I mean, if you think about all the things that are being discussed, the ways that people are talking about things that are based off of falsehoods and misinformation and, you know, rampant conspiracy theories. Mm-hmm. These false beliefs have taken over our political discourse, and we have reached a point where people are making decisions based on things that just simply aren't true. Mm-hmm. And news literacy is the skills and the knowledge to encourage people to be able to verify information for themselves independently, to be able to verify the authenticity and reliability of the sources of that information, and how to prioritize information from reputable ethical sources, including standards-based news organizations.
Mm-hmm. The more people don't understand something, that's where misinformation and distrust kind of sneaks in, right? So having a clearer understanding of news literacy, what that means, how to recognize information that is fair, accurate, et cetera, standard-based news organizations, that's the core. Because then we can mm-hmm. build from there.
You still have people who believe that Joe Biden is not the legitimately, fairly elected president. Conspiracy theories that are rampant in online spaces, claiming that former President Trump will be reinstated to the presidency anytime. We have all these calls for these audits, and, you know, people who are not trusting what seems to have been, by all other evidence, by objective evidence, one of the most secure elections we've ever had. But because of the big falsehoods, the constant drumbeat of the stolen election, you know, people are doubting that. And that's really causing this huge distrust in our elections and our elected officials. And it's really doing some major damage to civic engagement and even just, you know, the health of our democracy.
Mm-hmm. Probably for a little bit of context, John spends a lot of time online in the deep crevices, mm-hmm. takes one for the team, right, mm-hmm. of misinformation, right? Mm-hmm. Because what we do is also help people learn how to debunk information like that. One of the lessons, more recent lessons we launched, was conspiratorial thinking. And John played a really crucial role in helping develop that.
How long has the News Literacy Project been going on? And how have you taken on this huge problem that isn't necessarily new, but seems to have reached, you know, a bit of a fever pitch recently? Mm-hmm.
The News Literacy Project has been around for a little over 13 years. It was started by Alan Miller. He's our founder and CEO, former investigative journalist from the Los Angeles Times, actually a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist. And he was attending a career day at his daughter's middle school in Maryland, talking about journalism and what it's like to be a journalist. And when he came out of that, he realized first that, like, young people and the teachers didn't really understand what journalism is and how it works and how complicated it is. And he also realized that there was a need for an organization and resources to teach not only about journalism in general, but about this broader idea of news literacy. So he founded the organization. We have a couple different things of what we're trying to do. First is we're trying to advocate for news literacy education. We want to tell people about what news literacy is, why it's important, and we want to see news literacy embedded in the American education experience across grade levels and subject areas. And along with that advocacy, we develop educational resources that educators can take into their classroom and use with students. At the same time, we also facilitate and provide professional learning for those educators so that they can understand what news literacy is. And we can talk about strategies and how do we teach this and how do we make this enrich the curriculum, right? Because we don't want news literacy to be seen as like a unit, right? Mm-hmm. News literacy isn't mm-hmm. something that you do and then you kind of move on. News literacy, when you look at the skills and the knowledge and how it applies, can really become the heartbeat of a course with reinforcing the other things that a teacher is doing in the classroom. So that's what our professional learning does, is we say like, look, here's how this applies to other things that you're doing. Here's how it enriches it and supplements it. And then we try to support the educators in, you know, in an ongoing way. So it's all of these things together so that we want, you know, we want to be partners with educators to help bring this to their students and hopefully make them more active, engaged, and informed participants in the civic life of their communities.
Mm-hmm. That all sounds really great and extremely important and valuable in today's context. I'm wondering about this, though. Given the pressures that are on teachers to teach a wide variety of things and to prepare their students for standardized tests, regents exams, and things like that, how do you think about making news literacy the heartbeat of the course, as you said, when teachers do have a lot of ground to cover?
Mm-hmm. So there's a couple of different ways that that works, right? So some states have started to adopt new and very much updated civic standards for how do we teach civics to this current generation. And it's much more about sort of active and participatory civics. Mm-hmm. And foundational to civics education is how reliably informed you are when you try to be engaged in some sort of civic action, right? Mm-hmm. So news literacy fits in very well with those types of standards.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Additionally, some states have been adding, you know, more specific media literacy and some news literacy standards. But then when you look at other standards for different subject areas, the ability to evaluate information, the ability to verify the authenticity and reliability of a source, the ability to determine whether or not an argument is supported with evidence or if it's supported by logical fallacies, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, understanding mm-hmm. cognitive biases, evaluating mm-hmm. science in the news.
Yeah.
Evaluating information is fundamental to so many subject areas. And so when we talk mm-hmm. about these skills, we help support that by connecting across those areas.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Part of what is missing that we try to address also is in news literacy, right? And media literacy, we have the assumption that because our students are digital natives, that they're not digitally naive. We've missed the point where we get to teach them how to put all these things together to verify information. Is it real? Is it not? Right? It's if you're basing all your decisions and actions and emotions on something that is false, like how do you move through life? So we try to get to the point where we help the educators and the general public, right? And educators specifically because, well, they're going to amplify this to their students, right? So, and that's how we start, you know, changing the educational landscape. Mm-hmm.
Could you talk a little bit about the specific ways that you see teachers integrating news media literacy into their courses in a social studies class, which may be the most obvious place for it to go, and then another class where you could imagine it going, just so the listeners can have a clearer sense of what it actually looks like?
So I'm a former social studies teacher myself. I taught for 13 years here in mm-hmm. Chicago Public Schools. Mm-hmm. And as a history teacher, as a social studies teacher, you know, we are continually talking about how do we know what happened? What are the sources that we can go to where we can learn the who, the what, the where, and the when? That's where news literacy can help first, you know, bring a different perspective in terms of like understanding journalism, because that's what news journalism does. That's what reporters are doing, is telling us what happened, the who, the what, the where, the when. And, you know, there's a famous quote, journalism is the first draft of history. And mm-hmm. understanding how to evaluate that can help in a modern sense, it helps with the history context, but it also helps when we're talking about current events and things that are happening in civics and, you know, understanding how decisions are made. And so news literacy fits very comfortably in a social studies classroom that way, because, you know, history mm-hmm. teachers are continually about evaluating sources, researching the details, understanding what happened. Mm-hmm. In an English classroom, English teachers might be talking about rhetoric and logic and how do you evaluate an argument, or how do you write one yourself, right? Mm-hmm. An English teacher might be teaching persuasive writing. And so you might want to talk about logical fallacies and cognitive biases, right? And how you can use either emotion to persuade someone, or you can use facts. Mm-hmm. You know, a science classroom might go into some details about the discussions about climate change. How can mm-hmm. we talk about climate science and climate change from a science perspective when so much of the debate, the discussion about it is not based on science, but based on, you know, emotional belief and misinformation? Mm-hmm. To give one more example, you know, a math teacher might be very interested in talking about data visualization and statistics and how that can be manipulated in ways mm-hmm. to, mm-hmm. you know, you would think that statistics, you know, is, you know, it's something that, like, it's clear, this is what the data says, but, you know, data can be cherry picked, data can be manipulated, right? And so how can we evaluate that to understand if we're being told, like, from a mathematical interpretation, or did somebody cherry pick the statistic and have taken it out of context? So there's a lot of different ways that it can appear in the classroom. Mm-hmm.
And think of art classes and photography. So much of what our students consume it's image-based. Mm-hmm. So in a photography class, recognizing that visual imagery, if you're sighted anyway, that's a language in itself, mm-hmm. right? So how do you learn how to read that? How do you learn how to use your observation skills to see if the photo in the meme you're seeing online matches the context of the text? Mm-hmm. Or is it fabricated? Has the photo been manipulated? So there are news literacy deep dives you can do in just about every subject mm-hmm. matter.
Great. So you have a system that you call Checkology. I'm wondering if you could talk a bit about what Checkology is, what the Checkology lessons look like, mm-hmm. and what students seem to learn from them.
So the Checkology Virtual Classroom is our online learning platform. I should just mention here that Checkology, like all of our resources, is completely free. Mm-hmm. So Checkology has been online for just over 5 years. When NLP first started, it was a very resource-intensive classroom-based program, mainly in Washington, D.C., New York, and Chicago. In order to expand the reach and scale it and reach more educators, we developed this online learning platform. So Checkology is a self-contained web-based platform that has lessons, and then it has activities and other sort of enrichment supplemental activities that go to it. So for example, our InfoZones lesson. So the purpose of InfoZones is to teach students to recognize the primary purpose of a piece of information. Is it news? Is it opinion? Is it propaganda, entertainment, advertising, and mm-hmm. all raw mm-hmm. information? In that video, we have Tracy Potts, who is a journalist from NBC. And so each lesson has a subject matter expert who is in some way a journalism professional. We have Tracy in guided video instruction that takes students through the concepts. She introduces them to the concepts, explains some of the key vocabulary. So students are going through the lesson, and interspersed with the video content are different types of assessments. We use a number of formative assessments that sort of reinforce the skills as they're learning them. When Tracy introduces the concept of opinion, for example, we then have some assessments where students have to look at some examples and choose which one is opinion as opposed to something else. Mm-hmm. And so each lesson takes students through the concepts for each particular learning objective. Students can do them independently. Teachers can also introduce some blending with the platform, doing them in small groups or even as a whole class discussion, the lessons. And then the other thing about Checkology is that teachers can look at the content that we have in there and create a custom course of study for their students. They can see what we have in the platform and decide which lessons they want to emphasize. Mm-hmm. There isn't any particular sequence. There isn't any particular order. it can be completely customized by the teacher. So for example, they may want to be more journalism focused and talk about info zones and then like a lesson on news judgments.
Practicing quality journalism.
We have a simulation on how to write a story as a journalist. They may want to do more civics. And we have a lesson on the First Amendment, the five freedoms. We have a lesson on the watchdog role of investigative journalism, press freedoms around the world, for example. So there's a number of different ways that it approaches it. And that's so it has a great deal of flexibility for educators to decide what would work best for their particular curriculum needs. Mm-hmm.
Czechology specifically, could you talk about what that word means?
The essential guiding question for all the work that we do on the education team is, can your students sort fact from fiction? Right? That is our absolute core essential question. All of this is like guided from that question. And so the idea is like, do you know how to check? A, do you know when you should check something? And if you need to, can you actually do it? And that could be fact checking something simple. It could be verifying a source. It could be evaluating a news article for bias. But that's the basic idea behind all of the work that we do. At the end of the day, a news literate student knows how to sort fact from fiction.
You mentioned earlier something about the importance of students considering their own biases. I'm wondering if you could talk a bit about that and if you have any lessons that are geared towards that, which seems like a tough one and something that doesn't necessarily fit in with a particular subject matter, but does seem especially important given that we tend to gravitate to certain types of news sites and have certain kinds of feeds on our social media and whatnot.
Great that you asked.
So the first thing is understanding that everyone has biases, right? And biases on their face are generally neutral, right? And it's really important for us to first understand and confront confirmation bias. And so as you're mentioning, like we gravitate towards certain sources, right? When you look at your social media feeds, so much of what we consume is fueled by confirmation bias. When things agree with us, we like that. That feels very comfortable.
Right. Sorry. And then the algorithms give more of the same.
You know, those algorithms are part of this larger web. Like, we follow people that agree with us, like on Facebook and other social media platforms. These are people we have a connection to. So these create these like echo chambers. And so we want educators to recognize that it's important to teach that so we're aware of it. So then we can push outside of those filter bubbles, those echo chambers, and confront our biases. The second part of that is we have to teach bias in a way that tries to get away from perception. This is one of the biggest challenges, is that when we talk about the bias of a news organization, when we talk about a bias of a particular person, so much of it is based on our perception of that source, right? I'll give you the example of, like, we will generally say that Fox News is conservative and MSNBC is liberal. And so if we see something from one of those, our confirmation biases will kick in and say, well, I'm not going to listen to that because it is liberal or conservative, right? Because we just presume that everything that those sources put out follows that particular bias. We want to confront that and say, let's actually get to a more nuanced, objective way of evaluating bias in the news. One of the first things is we have to differentiate news from opinion. So much of our discussions about bias is not really about the news. It's about all the commentary. And talking about bias and commentary is pointless because it's supposed to be biased, right? And actually, the discussions of bias in news is much more important because there are ways that biases creep into news coverage that can be very problematic.
Right.
One example that I've used recently, there is a police officer down in Atlanta who had been involved in the shooting of an unarmed black man. And he was fired from the police department, and he has since been charged with murder. He appealed his firing, and a civil service board reinstated him. When you look at the ways that news organizations have reported on that reinstatement, right, there are some ways that bias creeps in. So one way we talk about is demographic bias, right? white police officer. Some stories use his official police photo in the story. So he's in uniform with his badge. Mm-hmm. Other news organizations use the image from his mugshot because he's been charged with murder. Some news organizations in their headlines simply say that he was reinstated. And if you just do a surface read, it gives the impression that he's back on the force. He's actually working as a police officer. It's not till much later in the story that you learn that, yeah, it's a technicality. He's not, he's not an active police officer, and he's still been charged with murder. And so there's things like that. So Mary mentioned the visuals, right? What visuals do we use to illustrate a story? Is it the mugshot, or is it the person in the cap and gown? The language that we use to describe certain things. Mm-hmm. Also things like big story bias. There are some news organizations that are reporting every time someone dies or has some unexplained illness shortly after receiving the COVID vaccine. Even if there's absolutely no connection between the two, these news organizations are sort of reporting it, and it's like blowing up the story, right? Because they're trying, it's that big story bias. The idea is that we want to get to a point where we have a more objective evaluation of bias, trying to recognize our own and trying to remove perception from the conversation. And it is a very nuanced, very tricky topic to discuss. And it's one that actually has to be done in a very deliberate way in the classroom.
Thankfully, we also have a Czechology lesson called Understanding Bias. So that can help educators figure out how do we begin this conversation, right? Mm-hmm. And bring in the nuance and talk about the different types of biases and how it can show up, but also how do you minimize it?
Mm-hmm. Could you talk a bit about that lesson?
The basic idea is that we want to talk about what bias is, talk about the different ways that bias, that we have our own biases. So we talk about confirmation bias, for example, right? And then we get into what we call the five types. So for example, I mentioned demographic bias. We also have things like corporate bias. Mm-hmm. When we see the influence of the corporate ownership of a news organization influencing coverage. It's pretty rare, but it does happen. And then partisan bias, right, is when we see the political viewpoints creep into news coverage. And part of it is also when we talk about framing. So framing is what we call is part of the forms. Framing and tone are when we talk about the language that we use. Mm-hmm. Some news organizations like to use much more loaded adjectives to describe events and people. We also see story selection bias, for example, when news organizations give greater coverage for one thing or another. One of my favorite examples of that is natural disasters, right? Mm-hmm. Whenever there's a hurricane bearing down on either the Gulf Coast or the Atlantic, news organizations, they send people out and there's live shots and there's almost wall-to-wall coverage of these hurricanes. Meanwhile, half of California is on fire. Entire towns are being, like the town of Paradise in Northern California was almost completely wiped out in a massive fire. And, you don't see that same level of coverage. There's some interesting discussion questions in there, right? It's like, so what makes a news organization place greater emphasis on a hurricane, which happens every year, multiple times a year, over these massive wildfires? And so, story selection is really important. Also, like with local news, right? New local news organizations have to make decisions about how much do we cover in our local community and how much do we cover, the bigger national issues. And so, there are some biases can creep into there. So that's the idea behind this, is that we want young people to recognize that there are ways that biases creep in. And it's really important to have clear vocabulary so that we can evaluate these types and forms objectively.
Mm-hmm. When we're thinking about where we get our news from, rather than going just to a national paper, think about, okay, what community is that? What news source in that area can I also look at for more in-depth coverage? I think that's a little bit where the lateral reading comes in a bit better too, expanding our horizons.
That was Miriam Romais and John Silva of the News Literacy Project. To learn more about the News Literacy Project, you can click on the links in the show notes. Please stay tuned for part 2 of the interview, which will be released shortly. and this is Education for Sustainable Democracy. I'm Brett Levy. To learn more about the show and to check out other episodes, please visit www.esdpodcast.org. That's esdpodcast.org. To help support the show, please subscribe, like us on Facebook, and tell a friend or two about the show. Thank you so much, and have a great day.